3, 2, 1.
The History with Jackson Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the History of Jackson Podcast, the podcast where we bring up-to-date historical research to you in an accessible and digestible way. So, welcome back everyone to the podcast, if it's the second time listening, or third time, fourth time, so on, or welcome if it is your first time. And today we're talking to historian and author Caitlin Carter, all about her book With Yale, and I absolutely love this book. I can't wait to talk about it. Democracy in Darkness, Secrecy and Transparency in the Age of Revolutions. Now, I've got my copy here. Now, something important about not only the quality of books is how they feel and the quality of the covers. And I think this is a gorgeous looking book as well. Really, really talks to what Caitlin talks about in her book. So I just want to ask you, Caitlin, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk.
No, it's completely fine. I was so excited when I got the opportunity to talk about democracy in these two countries with you. But I suppose the first question that really talks about any historian or author's work is, what inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, there are a couple things that inspired me, I suppose, to write this book. One is, you might be familiar with the fact that the Washington Post, one of the biggest newspapers in the United States, their tagline, which is under their masthead every day, is that democracy dies in darkness. Right. And, you know, I'd seen that before. It's such a very familiar sentiment that we have today. And yet I knew that the Constitution of the United States was written behind closed doors in secrecy, actually. And I thought, you know, there's something to this. That's very curious. You know, we have such an emphasis on the need for transparency in our democracies. And yet secrecy played such a prominent role in the founding, at least of democracy in the United States. So I was really curious about that. And I thought that needs to be explained. I think that, you know, there's something there. So that's one thing that kind of inspired me to write it. The other thing, I suppose, is that before I went to graduate school for history, I actually worked in Washington, D.C. for a couple years doing media relations. And I was just really interested when I was doing that in how elected officials thought about their relationship with their constituents, and also the role of the media in that relationship between elected officials and the public. So these are kind of questions that have always interested me since before I actually went to study history academically.
I always love listening to authors and historians talk about what inspired them, because so many areas of your personal life come into the book and how they join together to talk about those stories and bring those stories. You mentioned a couple of terms there, and you also mentioned a couple of terms in your book, which I feel that whilst I know we're going to have a fantastic conversation, I feel that we should define them before we go on. And those terms are representative democracy, secrecy and transparency. Now, I think a lot of us might take them for granted now, but could you just define them for us?
Yeah, I mean, that first term you mentioned, representative democracy, I think that that's one we probably take most for granted. So representative government is today the most common form of democracy around the world. And we, like you said, take for granted that representative government is a form of democracy. That was not as true in the 18th century when these first kind of modern representative democracies were set up. It's actually in the late 18th century that we can see that term, representative democracy, coming into being and coming into use for the first time. And before this, there's a lot of kind of anxiety, or I guess is one way to put it, of thinking about the differences between representative government and democracy. So, you know, in the 18th century, when people are thinking about democracy, they're often thinking about an ancient style of government, you know, ancient Greece, this notion that everyone is actively involved in political decision making. And of course, in a representative government, that's not true. People elect representatives to then go and deliberate in their interest. And so the fusion of those concepts to say, well, actually, representative government can be a form of democracy, that took a lot of work, and that's a creation of the late 18th century. So I try to recover that those tensions in my book and look at how those concepts got put together so successfully that today we just kind of think of that as a natural a link, you know, between those two ideas. So that's the first one. And then you mentioned secrecy and transparency. Secrecy, that's a term that people in the 18th century were using pretty commonly, and they're using it to mean pretty similar to what we use it today. So in that sense, that kind of is direct. But transparency, that is actually, though, a concept that I found people had in the 18th century. They're not really using that word in the way that we use it today to refer to, you know, visible government or a kind of accessibility to government documents or deliberations. They're more using the term publicity, or in French, publicité, to kind of connote the opposite of secrecy. And in fact, that it's always interesting because people today hear that term and they often think, I think of advertising or kind of spectacle, right? Something more calculated. And I kind of trace in my book how it comes to take on those connotations. But in fact, it is kind of a very unstable term in the period that I'm writing about, where lots of people are trying to kind of flesh out what exactly publicity means and kind of capture that essence of transparency, which we would use as the term to describe a lot of the things they talk about in terms of publicity.
And when you talk about fleshing out, I think it's something that's incredibly prevalent throughout your book, is there's a lot of these ideas of trying to flesh out what people are trying to achieve and what they should be doing for their nation whilst looking forward. But there seems to also be some looking back and looking back into different historical governments, such as the British political system.
Yes. Yeah.
How does the British political system influence that early American political system?
Very much. I mean, in a lot of ways, they're growing out of the British political system, and they're also reacting against things that they don't like about the British political system, you know, coming out of the Revolutionary War. So there are two ways, I guess, and especially if we think about the role of secrecy in the British political system in the 18th century, there are sort of two ways that that affects American thinking about this concept and government. One is that Americans before their revolution are very tuned into emergent reform movements and efforts in Great Britain itself, especially the effort to open the House of Commons to reporters and allow the public to come inside and witness deliberations and publish them in print, which unofficially happens in 1771, which is right before the American Revolution. But those efforts are very tied to a lot of people rethinking what representation means even within the British political system as it already exists. And Americans are really tuned into that. So they're thinking about that. The other kind of major influence or way that they're thinking about politics in relation to the system in Great Britain is just the aspect of distance. So one of the things that the colonists, when they're still colonists, are so frustrated with is that they're frankly just so far away from London that they find it very difficult to keep track of what's happening in the House of Commons. So not only are they upset that they don't have MPs themselves or that they don't vote for MPs to send there, but they also feel like the House of Commons, Parliament, is so far away from them that it's very hard to communicate, that it would be hard for anyone in the House of Commons to really know what the interests of the Americans are. And it would be hard for the Americans to know what they're doing in London in a timely manner. So that is kind of related to this idea of secrecy. Basically, there's this kind of impediment to communication that they view as really necessary for offering consent to the laws that are being imposed upon them. So I say those are kind of two major ways that their experience with the British political system preceding the revolution really influences their thinking about representative governments that they set up once they're independent.
And then on the other hand, in your other case study, you have another system with a monarchy, but yeah, perhaps differently shaped. How does the ideas of the French Revolution represent a departure from that system that France had?
Yeah, it represents a very big departure, to put it in short. Yeah, so before the French Revolution, France is governed by an absolute monarchy. And of course, that's theoretical. It's never, you know, totally achieved. The dream of the absolute monarchy for the monarch is never, you know, completely achieved, but that's kind of the ideal and the goal. And so Louis XIV famously said, "L'État, c'est moi," right? The state is me. And so there's this real centralization of authority. There's this concentration of sovereignty in the person of the king. And the French Revolution really upends that entire concept and tries to shift sovereignty to the people. So with the French Revolution, we see this new idea that, no, the people are sovereign. And at first, the king is part of this as a servant of the people. And then, of course, once they do away with the monarchy and behead Louis XVI, they become a republic. And really, it is the people are sovereign. And so they are putting into place then representative institutions to try to put that into practice. So it represents a major shift for them, a bigger shift than for the Americans, who, of course, were leaving a monarchy, you know, the British monarchy. But the British had parliament, right? They already did have systems of representation that are built into that, a constitutional monarchy, in a way that France did not really before the revolution.
And I always find it fascinating how the different balances of power that were put in place led to different systems emerging, but similar systems. But with these new systems that are in place after the American Revolution and the French Revolution, they're trying to create a new government, create a new state. How do they balance, and how do these founding fathers and these political figures, how do they try and balance the need for openness, which is fundamentally something that they wanted, but then encountering that need for secrecy as well? How do they balance that?
Yeah, well, as I talk about in the book, I think this is one of the hardest balances they have to strike. And they quickly figure that out in both contexts. Because leading up to both of these revolutions, there really is a demand, a pretty widespread demand for more publicity, more transparency in government. In France, for example, that's one of the main gripes people have with the monarchy, is that it's so secretive. And that politics is considered the secret of the state, and it's not something that's public. So for the French revolutionaries, when they're going in, they really, they sort of have to act transparently in order to gain any kind of public trust. Like, using secrecy has really become discredited. And they also see it as, frankly, empowering for them, because it helps define them in distinction to the monarchy. And they feel if the public knows what they're doing, you know, that can empower them against attempts that the king might make to shut down their political projects. So transparency is very, very important to them. But as they get to work and start trying to write a constitution, start trying to legislate and respond to crises that come up, they quickly find that having the public know everything about what's going on, and having deputies having to think about, oh, what I say is going to be reported in the newspaper, or people back home are going to hear about it, that really makes things very tricky for them very quickly, when, you know, they might want to make decisions that are not at least perceived as very popular. And when that happens, you have a lot of people outside of government coming and saying, wait a minute, you're our representatives. You're supposed to align with public opinion. You're supposed to do what we want you to do. And when they can see that that's not happening throughout the process of deliberating and passing legislation, then it starts to really undermine the legitimacy of this government as a voice of the people, when it appears that they're making decisions that don't align with what the people want. So that creates a really difficult tension for them. There's this imperative, this need to work publicly and to have this transparency, but having it is undermining their legitimacy at the same time. And quickly you see a lot of these deputies in the National Assembly start to realize that, in fact, there are some practical needs for secrecy in government, for some closed door spaces that are not entirely transparent and visible to the public. But of course, reintroducing that is really contentious and complicated. So I trace debates like that through the book, and I try to argue that it's kind of along that axis that people are defining what it means to be representative. You know, when is secrecy okay? And when do things have to be transparent? Those are really hard questions for them to answer.
It's really interesting seeing that play out through the book. And I think one person who I found really grapple with the idea of secrecy and openness was John Adams. Mm-hmm. What was his approach to that? Because it's not just him that has an approach, it's his family, really.
Yeah, John Adams is a really interesting figure. So in the United States, something that I trace through the book is kind of how during the war for independence, there's a very heavy reliance on secrecy in the Continental Congress, which is sort of the governing body of the Union as they're conducting the war. And there's a heavy reliance on secrecy, despite all the skepticism, you know, that they had of secrecy in the British system, you know, leading up to the war. But they're fighting this war, and it's kind of justified in that way, that for strategic reasons, you know, that they need to work in secret. But as the war kind of goes on, and as the Continental Congress starts to become a more entrenched institution that looks like it's sticking around, you start to see a lot of critiques of secrecy and people calling for more transparency in this body. And John Adams is a really interesting figure. He's, of course, in the Continental Congress at points during the war. And he writes sometimes kind of lamenting that they have to meet in secret. He kind of contrasts it to conversations that are happening in coffee houses, and where he says, you know, those are open conversations. And when we can't write to our friends candidly, when we can't have those conversations, it kind of binds us and makes it hard for us to do our jobs. But at the same time, he remains very committed to secrecy. And then going forward, once he becomes the second president of the United States in the latter part of the 1790s, and he, by that point, is pretty committed to a theory that secrecy has actual utility in government, and that if you want to have a stable government that's going to make wise policy decisions, and also if you want to maintain good relations with other countries, that it requires a certain degree of secrecy. And his members of his family, as you notice, not just him, but members of his family, Abigail Adams, his wife, but also his children, repeatedly in their correspondence kind of really question when doors get opened to the Senate, for example, in the mid 1790s, or even when the doors to the House of Representatives are open immediately in 1789, when it's established, they express a lot of hesitancy about that and sort of skepticism and concern for what that might do to politics and the destabilizing effect that might have on politics. So yeah, in that way, Adams and his family are kind of characteristic of a Federalist, which is the party he's part of, a Federalist conception of representative government and the place of secrecy in it, that it has utility despite some of the potential drawbacks.
Particularly like the way that Abigail Adams and John discussed the way that they felt about secrecy. But across the Atlantic, there seemed to be a kind of different approach with the Reign of Terror occurring in France. And you also have some issues with Louis XIV having even more secrets, or people thinking that he has secrets. So how does the need for secrecy emerge with these events, but in a different way to what the Americans need?
Yeah, so like I was saying, secrecy is very associated with the monarchy in France and the going into the revolution in the early stages. And Louis XVI doesn't help matters in that way. In 1791, he tries to flee the country, of course, and it's kind of portrayed, it's confusing. It ends up being kind of portrayed as, oh, it was a kidnapping, but then they discover a letter he left behind, you know, actually saying, no, I am leaving. I denounce this revolution and all the problems that he has with it. And so he loses a lot of legitimacy there and kind of public trust. And then, of course, he's deposed in a crowd action in 1792. And before he's put on trial, there's a safe of papers that's discovered hidden in a wall of the palace. And it seems to, it takes on this kind of big place in the popular imagination as look at all these secrets, you know, the king. And it doesn't show a ton of stuff that people didn't already know. But one thing it does show is that he was working pretty extensively behind the scenes to try to influence public opinion. He was making different kind of alliances with deputies in the national legislature. And that comes out with these papers. And so there's this real kind of rash of anxiety, like, well, you know, look, there were all these secrets going on. Who can we trust, actually? You know, there were these deputies who were working with the king, all behind, you know, outside public view. So this happens, of course, you know, just months before the beginning of what's known as the terror. And so going into the terror, there is this kind of renewed suspicion in secrets, and, you know, where are secrets lurking? Who is maybe just wearing a mask? Who's not an authentic, you know, revolutionary? So you have that going into the terror, but then in a very strange way, the Jacobin leadership of the government, which takes over in the terror, Robespierre and his allies in the National Convention, they actually reintroduce a lot of secrecy into government. And it's very curious because the Jacobins had long been real champions of transparency. And even throughout the terror, someone like Robespierre continues to, you know, talk about the value of transparency in a representative government. And yet you have the Committee of Public Safety working entirely behind closed doors. They move a lot of work off the floor of the National Convention. So in the book, I kind of trace that disconnect between, you know, continuing to champion transparency, you know, rhetorically, but in practice, actually, during the terror, a lot of government is moved outside of public view, and secrecy is very prominent to it, despite their, you know, disavowal of that.
And there's the interesting party, I find, in exposing a lot of these, or maybe two parties, really, or two factors, I find exposing some of these secrets is the rise of a free press and leaking. Now, I think we're no stranger to political leaks now, but how do both of these ideas, how important are they to the shaping and the establishment of these new democracies? And how difficult is it for a free press to arise in such a situation?
Yeah, so a free press is envisioned as really crucial to the function of a representative democracy in these places. So a lot of people write about how this cannot be successful without a free press. and we see in both France and the United States that becoming very central to, you know, declarations of rights and sort of the structure of the systems that are set up. So though there's kind of broad recognition that this is very important, this is going to be crucial. And journalists are really eager to take up that role also. You know, reporters become really central figures in these new systems. And they're there, they're in these national assemblies, they're there, they're trying to record deliberations, they're developing new shorthand methods and ways of, you know, doing this. And there's this massive explosion in the periodical press as there's demand for this kind of information. So reporters are there, they're taking on this role, but it's not easy or uncomplicated for the press to try to fill this kind of role in facilitating a relationship between elected officials and the public. And there are many reasons for that. I mean, one that I kind of just mentioned, some of the technological limitations they face. You know, this is an era before recording devices. This is an era before even, you know, methods for amplifying voices. And when you're talking about being in the French National Assembly, you have like over 1,000 deputies in this huge room. It's hard to hear people. So these kind of limitations that they face. Reporters, of course, also have political biases. Like immediately you see a lot of partisanship in the press. That poses some anxieties and challenges. And then, of course, reporting and the press is also facing market incentives. And that can distort, you know, the civic role that they're playing in these new republics. So It's very complicated. And in fact, a lot of the things that we still talk about with relation to the role of the press or the media more broadly, especially if we include things like social media in our politics, a lot of the same fundamental concerns we have about those things, we can already see those being discussed in the 18th century as the press takes on this very central role in this new style of government. So yes, press, very, very important, but not uncomplicated. And in fact, we see in France and the United States, and even in Great Britain, actually, in the 1790s, attempts at government regulation of speech and the press. And a lot of that comes out of some of the concerns born of how do we manage this sort of explosion of information and misinformation, and how do we ensure that the truth is something that's actually secured in this process? So the press creates a lot of new challenges, new opportunities, but also new challenges for these countries.
I find it incredibly fascinating that a lot of the issues that they're discussing for these two revolutions and these two new fresh governments are still themes that are being touched on and discussed today. But the similarities between the systems I find incredibly fascinating. Yeah, how much did both of these systems influence one another?
Yeah, so one of the reasons I wrote the book to look at France and the United States together is because a lot of people were traveling back and forth between these two places, and a lot of people in each place were very aware of what was happening in the other. And so they were often thinking about these projects they had, the ideas that they're thinking about. They were often thinking about them in tandem and in communication with one another. So, for example, Thomas Jefferson is actually in Versailles at the opening of the Estates General, and he's there on one of the days early that summer when the king blocks the public from entering the assembly meetings, and he witnesses the crowd get very upset about this, and he sees the deputies come out and reassure the crowd that they're going to make sure they can be able to come inside. And that's formative on him. He writes about it in a letter back to John Jay, a prominent politician in the United States. So you have people who are moving around who are witnessing these things. There's no doubt for me that influences, someone like Jefferson's thinking about how political assemblies operate, what the effect might be of having them in crowded cities versus, trying to have them away from crowds, all of these kind of things. So they're definitely thinking about each other. I think that sometimes it gets a little bit overblown, the effect of the American Revolution on the French Revolution. There are people in France, especially, philosophers who are following what's happening in the United States. But more the effect, I would say, of the American Revolution on the French is the fiscal crisis that it creates for the monarchy, which is, of course, a huge factor leading to the revolution. Otherwise, when you have revolutionaries who are thinking about reforms they want to implement or changes they want to make, they are familiar with like the state constitutions in the independent states in America, and they are engaging with what's happening in the United States. But more so, they compare themselves to the British, actually. And I think a lot of French reformers, revolutionaries, don't usually see the United States as a model necessarily for France. So they're thinking about it, but they're not often following what the Americans are doing or kind of seeing that as a blueprint, I would say.
I think that brings up another point, Fred, there, that we've largely ignored Britain and the influence of Britain within this discussion. Yeah. Why is Britain such, barring obviously the empire, why is Britain such an important figure for revolutionaries and philosophical thinkers of both nations?
Yeah, well, I think that the British tend to get maybe sidelined in the stories of this period because they don't have a political revolution. Right. So we think about this period as the age of revolutions. Well, the British don't have one, right? And so something, though Great Britain, it's true, is not a focus in my book, it's there throughout. And I think that one way of thinking about that is that there are revolutions in political thought and sort of thinking about the political system in Britain that are happening in this time period. And people are really grappling with and rethinking, well, what does representation really mean? How is that being put into practice? And those things are happening within Great Britain, even if the government's not being overthrown or the government structure is not, you know, changing in the way that it is in France or in the United States. So that's one thing that I think it's important to keep that in mind because they're there. But I also think, yeah, the British are sort of this, they're another piece of what I would think of as a triangle, actually, between France and the United States, that a lot of information that's passing back and forth across the Atlantic is being filtered through a British press or a British perspective on for both sides. So actually, they're really crucial in that sense. Also, I think the French at least, and even the British with regard to the French, have a longer history of kind of defining their own self-conception or politics in distinction to one another. So I think the French are very used to looking across the English Channel and thinking about their own politics in comparison or in contrast in comparison to the British. And so that I think is very important. And then also if we think just about Americans, a lot of the news that they're getting from France, that's being filtered through British sources, for example. So there's really interesting work about how that distorts, you know, the Americans' views on the terror or what's actually happening in the French Revolution, because a lot of that news is coming through London. So yeah, the British are actually really important, I think, in this story.
And I really like how you've addressed a misconception that people have there about both the role of Britain within both of these revolutions. As it seems to just be a military one for the Americans, and we very rarely touch on the French Revolution here in Britain, mm-hmm. So it's interesting to get that perspective. But there's so many threads that I want to touch on. But I think the first one that I want to touch on is the idea of defining, and particularly the French idea of defining. And something that stuck out to me in your book was that you mentioned how the French revolutionaries have this need to keep redefining what representative democracy is for them. So what effect does this constant redefining of representative democracy have on the system and the legitimacy they're gaining from the public?
Yeah, I think this is true in France and in the United States. It's just in France that it is more tumultuous, I suppose, or more drastic. In the United States, a lot of the redefining that happens kind of within the constitutional structure that they do set, that they ratify and set up in 1789. And in the French context, of course, they keep breaking constitutions and writing new ones, right? And kind of changing it. So I think that, I mean, the effect of that is for the legitimacy of the government is obviously it undermines that legitimacy a lot because there's not a lot of traction that is gained. And every time that they are going through a process of kind of rethinking what they mean by political representation, how it should work, it's accompanied by a new constitution in a way that's not happening in the United States. So that just leads to a bit more instability. On the other hand, they are more explicit about that, and they are more, I would say that they do experiment with more democratic, if I would put it that way, like methods of structuring and operating the government than happens in the United States. So there's stability at the United States, but at the cost maybe of some of the more democratic possibilities or, you know, experimenting with that. So I would say that that's kind of the distinction there, or that's kind of the difference between the two.
I find that need to redefine and break very interesting, that French perspective and how it has a later effect on what happens in France. But before we touch on that, I need to talk about Thomas Jefferson as well, because
okay, yeah.
He also discusses his own revolution of 1800. How does Jefferson and his contradictions and his reams and reams of writing have an effect on shaping America?
Jefferson is full of contradictions, as you say, and there's so much scholarship that focuses on Jefferson's contradictions. And in that way, I think he is a really useful figure for thinking about the United States, because in some ways he almost embodies or encapsulates a lot of the contradictions of the United States, the early United States. One of the most obvious ways or common ways to think about this is his thinking and actions about slavery. So, he writes extensively through his life about his dislike for slavery. And at the same time, he enslaves more than 600 people, and he only ever frees like a handful of them. And so that kind of dissonance and contradiction, I find also, even just talking with students, it's really powerful to think about how can both of those things be true, and how, and what that says about human beings, and the fact that, even these founders, which tend to, people tend to revere as, almost godlike, right? That they're not, they're human beings, right? And so another way, and in my book, another way that I talk about Jefferson as very contradictory is that he, professes this very big commitment to transparency, to publicity and accessibility in government, and that representatives should be like the people. They should reflect what the people want. And of course, when he comes into the presidency in 1801, after, what he calls the Revolution of 1800, kicking Federalists out of power, it's this big change, this big kind of turnover to his vision, his party, the Democratic Republicans. He comes into office and he really is like, this is a new day. We're going to have a government that is for the people, and we're going to have transparency. We're going to, let the press be free, and we're very open. Well, he's doing that, but at the same time, he's deploying a lot of secrecy in the way that he governs in practice. And even a lot of his commitments to, free press, as he's in office, he starts to walk some of those back or kind of question some of those as he's on the receiving end of a lot of, critical press or misinformation and things like this that he starts to get concerned about as well. So he's contradictory in that way too. And I think that it has a big impact for American government and politics going forward, which is that he plays a big role in kind of defining what publicity, what transparency means, because he is so rhetorically committed to it. But in practice, what that comes to mean for him is really more of a performative kind of transparency, a performative kind of simplicity, or, that he's man of the people. But again, it's for performance. It's not really in the actual work or practice of governance. There, he's much more locked down. And of course, he's not really a common man. He's a very elite, kind of aristocratic type of figure. So his contradictions are really fascinating to explore. And I think they can tell us a lot about the early United States.
And whilst those contradictions are at play during his presidency, the American system obviously continues, and it stays, very much remains today, the strength of which we shall not comment on. But the French system, on the other hand, doesn't. So how do we get to that point where the American system is able to continue and grow and go from strength to strength, whilst the French system is not?
Yeah, I think that a lot of it does come down to, and I wouldn't say this explains it all, but obviously I wrote a book about it, so I do think it explains a lot, which is the place of secrecy and transparency in the founding of these systems. So the American system, there was a lot of secrecy involved in kind of creating the foundational legitimacy of this ultimately kind of fiction of popular sovereignty, right? It's a constitution written in the name of the people. It's actually written behind closed doors, then ratified through, a small number of people, ratifying conventions. And over time, different branches of the government start to open more doors kind of gradually. But it's kind of after a lot of the more radical implications of transparency have been sort of tamed. There's a prominent use of secrecy through the early republic to kind of prevent any kind of disruptive popular disagreement with policies that might not be that popular until after those policies have already passed. And then people find out about them and they're mad about them. But that's been a little bit, that's been delayed, right, until they've been implemented. And so it kind of buys that time. And even if we think about Jefferson coming into office in the Revolution of 1800, that could have broken the Constitution. A lot of people thought that election would break the Constitution because there was deadlock in the Electoral College. It took many, many rounds of balloting to actually get to a president. And I think it's pretty compelling that part of the reason that that is able to work within the structure, despite the flaws of the constitutional structure, is because of the way that a lot of that is done in secrecy. A lot of compromises and things were cut behind closed doors. And then, you know, after the election, there's an amendment added to the Constitution to change the process of electing the president to try to avoid something like that happening again. But all that change, the secrecy allows for sort of, I don't know how to best put this, kind of fudging within the system in order to make it work and then trying to fix the system going forward. So that happens in the US. In France, it's much more unstable. And I think a lot of the reason why is because there are really genuine commitments to transparency through a lot of the revolution that under, like I was talking about earlier, kind of undermine that legitimacy or that ability to establish kind of that foundational legitimacy of or trust among the people that the government is a voice of the people. You instead have just kind of constant disagreement or moments of discord between the actions the government's taking and what public opinion seems to want. And it's hard for them to kind of get caught up or like stabilize that when everything is done kind of out in the open. So that becomes very destabilizing in the French context.
And I find those dissimilarities within two very similar events so fascinating, and seeing how they create different futures for those two regimes, obviously with Napoleon and then a system that remains as well. But I know we've already touched on this issue, this podcast, but I kind of wanted to make it a bigger feature as well, because I think it is just so important. You know, why and how is secrecy in democracy still an issue today? Because in your book, you talk about not only presidents like Washington, Adams, and Jefferson, but you also discuss more modern presidents having their own secrets and more modern secrets within other political systems as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck by that when I was working on this book, how similar in some ways some of the debates we still have about secrets in government are to the 18th century, which is striking because obviously there's been a lot of technological change. There's been a lot of, you know, just time that has passed since then. And yet we still have some debates that are fundamentally pretty similar to debates that they were having in the 18th century. And I think that that's because we've not really ever definitively settled how representative democracy should work or how we want it to work. There's always this kind of tension within it between, you know, do we want our elected officials to go to the Capitol and, you know, use their wisdom and, you know, we say we've elected you because we trust you. You're going to know more information than me. And we want you to make the best decision, you know, vote your conscience, so to speak. We want you to make the best decisions with the information you have. Sometimes we want that. Other times we send our elected officials to the Capitol and we say, well, you know, actually we want you to, follow public opinion polls in what you're doing. We want you to come back and consult us and we'll tell you what we want you to do. And I think there's a real tension there. And I think the reason why secrecy is so continues to be such a big issue is because it relates directly to those different visions for what we want government to be. So, you know, secrecy, having some secrecy in the government can facilitate elected officials going and making these decisions detached from public pressure, which sometimes we're, you know, happy about. And sometimes we think that's great. We want that. And then, you know, on the flip side, it really undermines that notion that elected officials should follow public opinion or should kind of listen to us and kind of do what we want them to do. The use of secrecy really undermines that. So if that's what we want at any given moment, if things are being done in secret, that's seen as a big problem, right? That it's kind of preventing that. So I think that that's kind of why it remains such a big issue, is because we're still, it's not totally settled exactly how we want elected officials to work. And so secrecy can be just really always kind of controversial and problematic, because it distills a lot of those bigger questions about how we want the government to work in our name, in our voices. And I don't know if we'll ever really settle that. I think it's kind of an ongoing just tension within democracy, but secrecy plays, I think, a really prominent role in that, which is why I think we still have so many debates about it today.
I think that's a lovely answer, you know, touching on our ideas and discussions about what we want government to be, what we want democracy to be, but also the human nature and how we want people to act for us. I think that's lovely. Now, I do have a final fun question for you. You know, when researching this book, and it is an awesome book, you've obviously uncovered an awful lot of secrets, but which one did you think was the most interesting secret that you came across?
That's such a great question. And actually, one of the hardest things about writing a book about secrecy is that, of course, the historical actors you're writing about wanted to keep these things secret. So that poses a lot of challenges. And that's something through my project I had to kind of face and think about how to approach. So thinking about that, I don't have necessarily a fun answer, unfortunately, because I think that the secret that I found the most interesting to think about was actually the way that slavery was treated in the American Constitution. Obviously, this is something that is continues to be a very central and controversial topic in the United States, especially. And I found it really interesting once I started to think about the fact that the convention that wrote the Constitution met in secret. Because it met in secret, we don't have a lot of reliable records about what was said in that convention, how deals got made, what the intentions were behind certain wording in the Constitution. And I just found it really fascinating to trace how, first of all, that was intentional, that the deputies wanted it that way. And then secondly, how that has allowed debates about how the Constitution dealt with slavery, that allowed debates to start about that right away, as soon as the public started debating ratifying, that continue today, that we still debate about. And the fact that it's very hard to definitively answer any of that because it was done in secret. I think for me, I just found that really interesting and also really reinforced for me how significant it is if it just procedural decisions about if a meeting is held behind closed doors or in the open, and how that just so drastically changes what we can know about what happened in that meeting for people at the time, and also, you know, for us as historians looking back.
I think that's a brilliant answer about those kind of ripples through history. I love that. So thank you very much for that. Now, obviously, Caitlin, people are going to, you know, they've listened to you talk about, you know, your book, and we've not touched on everything in your book. I think it's impossible for us to have touched on every moment of secrecy and transparency within Democracy in Darkness. So where can people grab a copy of your book, but also where can they interact with you online and learn more about your work?
Yeah, so my book is published with Yale University Press, so you can get it directly from the press. But you should be able to find it pretty much anywhere that you get books. You can get it on Amazon or in most big bookstores. In terms of where to find me online or more about my book, I'm an assistant professor of history at the University of Notre Dame in the United States. So you can find me on the history department website for the University of Notre Dame. And that has my contact information and also just links to other articles and things that I've written. And otherwise, I'm an editor and I frequently contribute to the Age of Revolutions blog, which has a ton of really cool content about this time period. And I highly recommend that also to listeners who might be interested in these kind of topics and this time period.
No, thank you very much for that. So I'll make sure a link for your book is in the description below, as well as a link for your Notre Dame profile and the Age of Revolutions as well. So people can go away and interact with everything that you do, but also grab a copy of your book. So thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Now, thank you very much for listening to this latest episode of the podcast where we spoke to Caitlin Carter all about her new book with Yale University Press, Democracy in Darkness, Secrecy and Transparency in the Age of Revolution. Now, I'm sure you can agree this was an illuminating conversation where we looked at the battle between the need for transparency and the need for secrecy in these post-revolutionary regimes of France and America. Now, I really, really enjoyed having this conversation. Now, if you enjoyed listening and learning from it and learning from Caitlin, and you enjoy the content here at History of Jackson, please do consider subscribing to History of Jackson Plus on Apple Podcasts or heading to the Buy Me a Coffee profile in the description below to support us. Our next episode is going to be another equally as illuminating conversation where we will learn so much more history yet again. Now, thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you all next week.